With Jerusalem besieged and Ben-Gurion preparing for war, what was transpiring in Washington was that the State Department, led by Secretary Marshall, was pursuing the opposite of Jewish independence, while Truman was moving towards supporting it. Thus it was that post-Passover, as Ben-Gurion began to prepare for a declaration of independence, a confrontation was about to occur. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 194, The President, the Secretary of State, and Eddie Jacobson. I'm Mayor Soloveitchik. Having told the tale of Pesach in Jerusalem, we ponder today what unfolded around this period of time in Washington, D.C. Following the passage in the prior year of UN Resolution 181, supporting the partition of Palestine and the birth of a Jewish state, Secretary George Marshall's State Department announced an embargo in the conflict. As Walter Russell Mead notes in his book, The Ark of the Covenant, this handed an enormous advantage to Israel's enemies. Marshall, Mead argues, was convinced that the Jews could not win a war against the United Arab assault, and that therefore it, quote, seemed incomprehensible to him that the United States should alienate Arab opinion, further stress its relationship with Great Britain, and distract itself and the world from the looming confrontation with the Soviets in Berlin, end quote. Secretary Marshall's State Department, therefore, began to support a reversal of the partition plan, and thereby an undoing of an intended independent Jewish state. In the face of Marshall's opposition, Truman's friend and former haberdashery partner, Eddie Jacobson, pleaded with the president to meet with Chaim Weizmann. While it is unclear, and historians discuss, what originally Truman had said to Marshall, the meeting with Jacobson would set the stage for a fascinating division in the administration between the President of the United States and a Secretary of State that he very much admired. Jacobson desperately reached out to Truman, pleading with him to meet with Weizmann. But the president, believing that some of the American Zionist leaders had been disrespectful to him, did not respond. Jacobson then showed up on his own at the Oval Office, and the president's assistant, Matt Connolly, allowed Jacobson to walk in to see Truman on the condition that he did not bring up the issue of the Holy Land. We pick up the story as told wonderfully by David McCullough in his biography of Truman. Quote, entering Truman's office, shaking hands with his old friend, Jacobson was pleased to see how well he looked. Florida had done him good, Jacobson said. For a while they chatted about their families and Jacobson's business, a subject in which Truman, Jacobson said, always had a brother's interest, end quote. Of course, Jacobson did not do as he promised Connolly. He had come to talk about the Holy Land. I cite again from David McCullough, who brings us as part of his account select portions of what Jacobson said to Truman. Quote, Jacobson brought up Palestine. Truman, suddenly tense and grim-faced, responded in a hard, abrupt fashion. Not at all like himself, Jacobson thought. In all the years of our friendship, he never talked to me in this manner, or in any way even approaching it, Jacobson would remember. On a table to the right, against the wall, was one of the president's prized possessions, a small bronze of Andrew Jackson on horseback, the model of the statue by Charles Keck that Truman had commissioned for the Jackson County Courthouse in Kansas City. Jacobson had noticed it on other visits, but now, pointing to it, he found himself making an impassioned speech. Harry, all your life you have had a hero. I too have a hero, a man I never met, but who is, I think, the greatest Jew who ever lived. I am talking about Chaim Weizmann. He is a very sick man, almost broken in health, but he traveled thousands of miles just to see you and plead the cause of my people. Now you refuse to see him just because you are insulted by some of our American Jewish leaders, even though you know that Weizmann had absolutely nothing to do with these insults and would be the last man to be party to them. It doesn't sound like you, Harry, because I thought you could take this stuff they have been handing out. McCullough continues, as Abba Ibn later wrote, the comparison between Weizmann and Andrew Jackson was unimaginably far-fetched, and it worked. Truman began drumming his fingers on the desk. He wheeled around in his chair and with his back to Jacobson sat looking out the window into the garden. For what to Jacobson seemed like centuries, neither of them said anything. Then, swinging about and looking Jacobson in the eye, Truman said what Jacobson later described as the most endearing words he ever heard. You win, you bald-headed SOB. I will see him. From the White House, Jacobson walked directly across Lafayette Square and up 16th Street to the bar at the Statler, where, as never before in his life, he downed two double bourbons. End quote. Many people tell this story. I tell this story. It is an important story. But its importance, in my view, increases as we remember what happened next. To Truman's shock, Warren Austin, the chief of the American delegation at the United Nations, announced American support for a trusteeship. Alice and Ronald Radosh, in their book A Safe Haven, Harry S. Truman and the Founding of Israel, tell us that Weizmann's wife, Vera, recorded in her diary that immediately after the meeting, Truman had told her husband that he still, quote-unquote, supported partition. And Truman's assistant, Clark Clifford, reported that after Austin's announcement at the UN, Truman was, quote, as disturbed as I have ever seen him, end quote, adding that, quote, I assured Chaim Weizmann that we were for partition and would stick to it. He must think I'm a plain liar, end quote. Historians record what Truman wrote in his diary after the announcement by Austin at the UN. Quote, this morning I find that the State Department has reversed my Palestine policy. The first I know about it is what I see in the papers. I am now in the position of a liar and a double crosser. I've never felt so in my life. There are people on the third and fourth levels of the State Department who have always wanted to cut my throat. They've succeeded in doing it, end quote. Meanwhile, as McCullough describes, Chaim Weizmann called Eddie Jacobson and told him to continue to lobby the president and that he still believed the president's words supporting partition. Weizmann, McCullough tells us, told Jacobson that, quote, his friend Harry S. Truman was the single most powerful man in the world and it was up to Jacobson to keep the White House door open, end quote. The Radocious further report, as I discussed in an essay about the subject in commentary, not only that Truman was shocked at the initial UN announcement by Austin, but that also, in an April 12th meeting with Jacobson, the president, according to Jacobson's recollection, quote, reaffirmed very strongly the promises he had made to Dr. Weizmann and me, and he gave me permission to tell Dr. Weizmann so, end quote. The Radocious further report that Truman's speechwriter, Sam Rosenman, was sent by the president to Weizmann to say that Truman had said, quote unquote, I have Dr. Weizmann on my conscience. Thus, as Austin at the UN and Marshall at the State Department sought to undo partition, they found no takers for the proposal of a trusteeship by the UN over Palestine. And the President of the United States himself was operating against them. Or as the Radocious put it, at the time that, quote, the State Department's proposals were floundering at the United Nations, the President was going in another direction, end quote. Thus, with Jerusalem besieged and Ben-Gurion preparing for war, what was transpiring in Washington was that the State Department, led by Secretary Marshall, was pursuing the opposite of Jewish independence, while Truman was moving towards supporting it. Thus it was that post-Passover, as Ben-Gurion began to prepare for a declaration of independence, a confrontation was about to occur between the president and the Secretary of State over the issue of recognizing Jewish independence. This story we will tell in the future. For now, as we consider the story of Truman's support for Israel, I would like to take note of a comment by Walter Russell Mead in his very interesting book. Mead gives a somewhat different analysis of Truman than mine, but no matter what approach one takes, Mead's larger point about America and Israel in his volume is very relevant to the story that we are telling. Mead argues that for many religious Americans, the story of Israel is important because it is proof that, quote, God exists, he drives history, he performs miracles in real time, God's word in the Bible is true, end quote. In my own view, this was part of the motivations of Truman, who would come to see biblical aspects in the unfolding of Israel's story. And it is safe to say that Truman was different in his fundamental approach to Israel than his predecessor. McCullough further writes that, quote, the two ardent champions of the Jewish cause on the White House staff were Clark Clifford and David K. Niles, Truman's special assistant for minority affairs. Niles, one of the holdovers from the Roosevelt years and himself a Jew, sensed in Truman a fundamental sympathy for the plight of the Jews that he had never felt with Roosevelt, end quote. It is this fundamental sympathy that would impact the confrontation with General Marshall that was to come over the issue of recognizing the Jewish state. We save this for our next episode and for the future unfolding of the incredible tale that is the story of the Jewish people, of the Holy Land, and of Jerusalem. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.